Talkers.
This is Speak and Destroy, Episode 5. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey, and my guest today is Rob Flynn, guitarist, vocalist, frontman, founder of Machine Head. As frontman of Machine Head, Rob Flynn is of course an important metal figure in his own right, responsible for records like Burn My Eyes and The More Things Change, both of which are modern metal classics. My personal favorite Machine Head record, Through the Ashes of Empires. And more recent and no less killer work like The Blackening, Unto the Locust, and 2014's Bloodstone and Diamonds. But Rob is also an unashamed and outspoken Metallica fan. Machine Head has not only covered Metallica in the past, and toured with them as part of the Death Magnetic World Tour. As a Bay Area native, who's a few years younger than the guys in Metallica, Rob had the unique vantage point of watching the birth of the thrash metal movement as a teenager in high school, and at the same time, participating in the Bay Area thrash movement as a founding member of third wave thrash bands Forbidden and Violence, a band that also included lead guitarist Phil Demmel, who of course reunited with Flynn in Machine Head, becoming the band's lead guitar player about 15 years ago. Now, I don't know that Rob remembers this, but the first time we met was actually in 1999. I was still living in Indianapolis at the time and was flown out on the Roadrunner Records dime to write a story about Machine Head for Circus Magazine. Of all publications. I came out to Hollywood for a few days, and I got to stay at the Riot Hyatt on Sunset, which was exciting for me at the time. I met with the band in the studio where they were mixing the album The Burning Red with Terry Date. And I remember my impression of Rob at the time was that he was very friendly, very charismatic, and I realized this is almost a cliche to say about a musician, but super passionate about the work that he was creating with Machine Head. The Burning Red gets a bad rap from some Machine Head fans, but I think From This Day is an amazing song. I think the title track, which is moody and vibey and is sort of like a metal version of The Cure's Disintegration record in a weird sort of way. There's a lot of great stuff on that record, and if you are a Machine Head fan and you haven't listened to it in a long time, I would highly recommend going back and revisiting it, as I did recently. And these are the kind of conversations you get into when you're a real fan of a band, the way that Rob and I are both fans of Metallica. We had a very fun, lively, engaging, and straightforward conversation about this band that we both love so much, and I think you're really going to enjoy listening to it. I got to know Rob a little bit better a few years later as a manager. I had both the bands Bleeding Through and Throwdown on tour with Machine Head at different times. There was a Machine Head Arch Enemy Throwdown tour at some point, and a world tour that was Machine Head Hatebreed and Bleeding Through that I think went to Europe, all through America, Australia, and Japan, if I'm not mistaken. So I've had a couple of different opportunities to get to sit down with him, and moreover, over the last couple of years, just writing emails back and forth about different topics that we're both passionate about. One thing I've always appreciated about Rob is the way that he stood up for my good friend Andy Biersack and the band Black Veil Brides after Black Veil's Revolver Golden Gods Awards acceptance speech, where Andy did battle with some hecklers and haters in the crowd. Verbal warfare. Rob is one of the people who, like myself, looked at that incident and said, hey, maybe I should give this band a look, because that's pretty badass and cool what this kid did standing up to a room full of, like, you know, construction worker-sized metalheads who were trashing him simply because of the way he looked or the way his band sounds. So anyway, Rob, I give you my eternal salute for having Andy's back and for having all of our back as an ambassador for metal and someone who always speaks his mind. And, you know, the best and most incredible, amazing thing that came out of all of that Machine Head and Bleeding Through touring together is that my good friend, someone who I've, has been like a family member to me going back to when we first met in 2003, Marta, the keyboard player for Bleeding Through, her and Phil Demmel met on those tours and fell in love. and are now married and raising two children together. Phil's son from a previous marriage and their new little one that they had together. Phil is an amazing dude. I couldn't be happier for both of them and couldn't be more psyched as kind of an older brother for her over the years that she ended up with somebody who's every bit as talented and killer as she is. So anyway, let's not get sappy here on Speak and Destroy because it's about Metallica and it's metal. Here is my interview with my pal, Rob Flynn of Machine Head. This is Speak and Destroy. You are a avowed super fan like myself, and I got to see one of those two forum shows that you did with Metallica in LA, which, man, was probably, I guess that was Death Magnetic, so.
Yeah, 08.
Yeah, 2008. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I've read a little bit about where you've spoken before about hearing Kill 'Em All for the first time in high school. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, Black Sabbath, I think, was a little bit before that for you.
For sure.
What was the heavy music sort of trajectory for young Robert Flynn?
I was listening to music for literally as long as I can. My earliest memories, you know, my earliest memories are Bad, Bad Leroy Brown, Baddest Man in the Whole Damn Town by Jim Croce. Nice. And so, you know, and I was living in this like pretty crusty part of San Lorenzo. And so the people that he was talking about in the song were like people in my neighborhood. And so I would look around and that song just held this, you know, those lyrics. I don't know. I mean, I can remember all the lyrics even now. And I was probably 4 or 5 singing that song. And I bought the single, you know, 45. Yeah. I'm showing my age here. I bought the 45 and I memorized all the lyrics.
You got a custom Continental. You got a Eldorado too. He got a 32 gun in his pocket for fun. He got a razor in his shoe. Bad, bad, bad Leroy Brown. Baddest man in the whole damn town. Better than old King Kong. Meaner than a junkyard dog.
And you know, so for me, that was like, it was just this really dark, gritty song. And it was about street life in this area, and I don't know, I just was really attracted to that. And then
well, you got me beat, because my first 45 was Neil Diamond, Coming to America from the
Jazz. Yeah, I mean for sure I had, you know, like all of those other pop things too, you know, because my parents listened to the radio. The pop station up here was KFRC, so they played, you know, Afternoon Delight and like, yeah, you know, yeah. I love that song too. But you know, I think that for a long time, my parents were pretty, you know, I think my parents were pretty open about the music they listened to. They would listen to a lot of R&B. So I listened to a lot of Black music growing up, you know, like tons of R&B, Earth, Wind & Fire, Commodores, you know, that was all the music that was played around my house. And then they both listened to the early Beatles, but I couldn't listen to the hippie Beatles. So like Sgt. Pepper's was off limits because it was like the drugged out Beatles.
The bad influence Beatles.
The bad influence Beatles. And so I had a friend, Eric, and he turned me on to Sgt. Pepper's, and I was hanging out at his house, and he turned me on to that record. And I just remember being like, what the fuck is this? And we would just listen to that record nonstop. And like, this is the craziest shit I've ever heard. You know, so the Beatles, you know, I don't know if that's considered heavy, but that was kind of my first introduction to, like, you know, music that was just not on. I mean, that wasn't even really on pop radio at that point. So then came, you know, I had another friend turn me on to AC/DC, Van Halen, you know, but at the same time it was, you know, Duran Duran and Devo.
Yeah.
And then I got into Van Halen, AC/DC, Black Sabbath about literally, I think, the same week. This friend of mine, Lori Kibbe, turned me on to, she played Heaven and Hell, Van Halen 1, and Highway to Hell. And I was just like, what the fuck is this? So it just, you know, this whole new thing happened. And then I really went down the Black Sabbath hole, you know, first time I smoked weed and, you know, just going on. And then I had a friend, Jim Pittman, who was in my art class. You know, we just hit it off. We sat next to each other, and he was listening to all this, like, he was the guy who really turned me on to all this underground music. You know, he was telling me about, you know, this radio station that plays stuff from 2 to 6 a.m. called KUSF. And, you know, he had these recordings. And so he would kind of pull me aside and play all this stuff. You know, at that time around, like Motley Crue's Too Fast for Love was out. And to me, that was like the heaviest new shit around. And so I was loving that. But he played Accept, you know, Restless and Wild. And then the Metallica demo came out. And it sounds super weird to say, but like, you know, they were just this young unsigned band, you know, and he had just heard this on the radio station. He recorded and he played me the song Whiplash. I'd never heard anything that fast. You know, I hadn't heard Motorhead or any of the kind of pre-thrash stuff at that point. You know, then we just went crazy. Like all we could do, he found out about all these record stores in San Francisco. And we were living in Fremont by then. And Fremont was just a, you know, a boring, gigantic suburb about 45 miles away from San Francisco. So, you know, you got to remember in like 1981, we might as well have been in fucking Nevada. You know, like right. If you were 55 miles away from the city, like no car, like you were just, you know, there was no connection. But that radio station, KUSF, was a college station out of San Francisco, and it barely made it out to Fremont, the radio waves.
Hello.
And you're not. You're listening to KUSF 90.3 FM dial.
And so him and I would stay up till 2 in the morning, and we'd take my little Radio Shack, you know, cassette recorder / radio, and aim my antenna and record these super staticky, crackly versions of Exodus demos and Metallica demos. And pretty soon we were taking Bart out to San Francisco and buying the Exodus demos and the Jump in the Fire demo. So, you know, for us, it was really early on that we were getting, and, you know, pretty much the first time I got drunk. You know, we went out, we're blasting Whiplash and walking around my high school and just screaming the lyrics at night. And these very early, cool memories of, you know, that's when Four Horsemen was still called Mechanics, you know, all that stuff. So
I just watched, it's funny you mentioned that, I just watched a pro shot video, I think it was from Vakken. I mean, it just went up on YouTube a couple days ago of Megadeth doing Mechanics, like recently, like just now. Dude, it still rips. I mean, I love both songs, but, you know, I got to say I prefer Four Horsemen lyrically.
Yeah, in retrospect, it was the right call to get rid of the lyrics, like, you know.
Yeah, but I do love how fast and pissed Mechanics is.
Screw than me. I do it for my life. You make my drive shaft crank. You make my pistons bulge.
make my ball bearings melt from the heat. So stupid. It's like hair metal level, like sex metaphor song.
Yeah. Sex innuendo via, you know, car parts.
Yeah, but I will give it up to Megadeth for how pissed and fast that version is.
It's really fast, right? Yeah. Like it's so fast, it's crazy.
And I mean, and him yelling "fuck yeah" is just it's always gonna make the hair stand up on my arms when I hear that "fuck yeah" in Mechanic. Oh, I'm giving you my room 5 hours, and you know it's more than enough.
I mean, it's funny, you know, it's funny too, because back then, you know, especially in those demo days, and you know, so he, like my, like I said, my friend would collect all these demos. He collected all these bootlegs. He traded tapes, which is, you know, people record these cassette tapes and then just duplicate them over and over. And there was this huge underground scene of tape traders who have these, you know, typed up 14-page lists with bootlegs and demos and underground cuts and B-sides. And so my buddy Jim Pittman just ended up getting like 14 – he had his own 14-page list of all this stuff. So we had live versions from all over and different demo versions. And, you know, it's funny because back then, like, you'd listen to these bootlegs, and it was really Mustaine who was the – quote unquote front man of Metallica.
Right.
You know, he was the guy who talked to the crowd. He was the kind of, I don't want to say the face of the band, but Hetfield was so kind of introverted at that point that I guess he just let Mustaine do the talking. I don't really know, you know.
Wasn't that you? The song's about an evil little motherfucker. We call him the Phantom Lord.
That was just my outsider. So when he got the boot, it was like, whoa, the main guy got kicked out.
Yeah.
Even though he really wasn't.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Well, and it's funny to me, you know, being a kid in the 80s and not understanding, you know, certainly the intricacies of songwriting and how publishing works and all the different viewpoints on how you divide up songwriting. I remember reading liner notes and seeing Mustaine's name in there. And it always being last, and just thinking like, okay, his name's last, so he probably had like some minimal contribution to the song. And then as an adult, you know, seeing Metallica at the 30th anniversary shows, and Lars saying, you know, when Dave came into the band, he was in this band Panic, and he had this song Jump in the Fire.
This is the first song that Dave brought to us, right? Because he had a band before called Panic. And there were a couple of things that Dave showed up and showed James and I. So this is the first song that that Dave showed us. Check it out.
We're going to play that song now. And you're like, wait a minute. It kind of sounds like this guy wrote a lot of music then. If, you know, if some of these were just straight up finished songs.
Yeah, it was probably just a dig at Mustaine. Like, we're putting you last.
Yeah, we're going to put you in here, but we're putting you last. Cause...
And you look at those credits, they go all the way to Master of Puppets, which is really shocking that they were still using his riffs. You know, that'd be like me using, you know, Logan Mater riffs well into my, record. Like, it's kind of crazy.
Exactly. And it's wild, too, when you even look at, you know, when you think about the Big Four and you look at how prolific each of those bands has been. And Metallica's always busy. You can never say that they aren't working. But in terms of studio albums, you know, the amount of original Metallica material that's out there is significantly less than those other three bands.
Yeah.
I want to mention something before we go too much further. I love that you mentioned your first exposure to Sabbath was actually Heaven and Hell. So it's I think that that's something that gets kind of lost in the annals of history was how important the Dio Sabbath era was even in making new fans and turning people on. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm a huge Judas Priest fan, of course, and I've gotten to interview Rob Halford before and a couple of times, and he's always lovely and great. But I mean, you know, my first exposure to Priest was Turbo. You know, and I didn't know that that was like the cold lake of Judas Priest.
Right.
You know, like I saw the video on MTV and I was like, whoa, this guy's cool. This song's weird. This video's sketchy, you know. And
right.
And then you go in and dig into like, you know, what everything you're supposed to like and love and that whole process of discovery. Yeah, I mean, somewhere out there, there's a kid whose first Iron Maiden show had Blaze Bailey on vocals.
Right.
It's like,
yeah. And to me, I love that record, you know, I mean, I love
absolutely.
That record. And granted, now I went down the rabbit hole after that. And then I was just, you know, fell in love with that early Sabbath. And, you know, if you were to like put a gun to my head and say, you know, Ozzy Sabbath or Dio Sabbath, of course I would say Ozzy Sabbath, you know, because I just, those songs resonated a lot. And there was just more of them. You know what I mean? There was more albums. There was more to dig into. There was more of a story. Obviously it was the original, you know, but yeah, you know, that record, you know, hit me like a ton of bricks. I couldn't get enough of that album, and I still love that album. And that was an important step, you know, for me. When I look at the chronology of Sabbath, you know, if I would have started on, say, Never Say Die or Technical Ecstasy, I probably never would have been a Sabbath fan, you know, because there were horrible records. They're garbage, you know. Like, yeah. I hate those records. As much as I love Black Sabbath, I can sit here as a fan and say, you know what, those records suck. You know, Johnny Blade, okay, I don't really like the song Never Say Die. But, you know, then you have that kind of rebirth with Dio, where they just had really good songs, you know, really well-crafted, well-structured songs with, you know, all the classic kind of elements, you know, back into the dark, more satanic vibe of Black Sabbath.
Yeah, I was going to say the imagery came back too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, like technical,
album cover, you know.
Yeah, those last two albums were really just like, I don't even know what the vibe was, you know, like it was very confusing to me going back and listening to it. And, you know, that Sabbath of Heaven and Hell was really, you know, dark and dirty and evil, which was, as a kid, you know, the teenager, was very appealing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting is that, you know, I've never grown up a punk and hardcore and metal kid and whatever, but with the exception of boxing and UFC these days, I never paid attention to sports. I've just never been a sports guy. And obviously I have a lot of friends who, you know, love football and basketball and whatever. Yeah, okay, right. So, but one thing I realized, and it was Metallica that brought me this realization, I finally came to understand sports fandom via my fandom of bands like Metallica and Black Sabbath. Because like you said, you love Sabbath, and there's like the totality of the whole Sabbath experience. But as a fan, you can still kind of nitpick and go like, I hate this album. I didn't like this. I didn't like, you know what I mean? And I realize it's kind of like hearing sports fans go like, well, I like the 1980 whatever Chicago Bears.
Right.
You know, the coach sucks this year or whatever. You know, it's like you have so much love that you can passionately even talk about the things that irritate you or that you wish had been done differently while still loving the whole thing. And it finally made me go like, oh yeah, it's like with Metallica.
Yeah. And plus plus with sports, it's competitive. So there's that thing that, you know, the competitive nature of it too. So,
yeah.
You know, who's going to win it. And
it's crazy bringing our conversation kind of full circle too, you know, thinking about you as a kid and discovering this stuff and being in high school and everything, and we're talking about Heaven and Hell, and we're talking about, you know, Mustaine's early role in Metallica. And then, of course, you know, 10 years ago, there was the Heaven and Hell Megadeth Machine Head tour.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally. Like, there you are, you know, from fan to contemporary.
That tour was, you know, I mean, we had toured with Megadeth before several times, so I knew them, but, you know, that was... And I had actually toured with Black Sabbath before when they did the Ozfest 97, and we were on it as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, even still, you know, there was 10 years between each of those tours. So it was 97 was the Sabbath original reunion with Ozzy, Mike Borden on drums, Geezer and Tony. And then 10 years later, it was the Heaven and Hell with Dio, you know, Geezer, Tony and Vinnie Appice on drums. And even still, you know, the Sabbath thing... You know, I don't really get starstruck, you know, anymore. There was a time when I did, and there's, you know, probably two people in the world who still have, like, you know, I'm kind of a little starstruck, and Iommi is definitely one of them. You know, like he would walk out of the dressing room, and my dressing room right next to his, or our dressing room, and he'd walk out, and I'd walk out at the same time just by happenstance, and he'd look over and he'd be like, "Hey, Rob," and I'd be like, "Hey, Tony Iommi, how you doing?" You know, and then he just walk on and kind of do what it goes every day. And I was like, this is so weird. It was never not weird. And it was always like, I always had to remind myself, like, all right, be cool. You know, like, just, you know, chill out.
Right.
You're here. You know, you're here. You're here. So you're obviously, you know, cool enough to kick it. You know, just remind yourself that. And, you know, but it's still just those riffs and that music and just everything was so, such a powerful influence. I mean, just so important, you know. And, you know, it's funny too, because I never really sat down and had like, I it was a couple times when I kind of, I don't want to say bro'd down with Tony Iommi, but like we had a good 10-minute conversation, You know, and that's all I want. You know, like, I don't want an right. autograph. I don't care about a selfie. I don't care about anything. Like, for me, like, I just want to pick somebody's brain. You know what I mean? Like, that's, you know, when I was hanging out with the Metallica dudes on that tour, like, I would just, you know, to me, the thrill of going out with them would be like, all right, I'm going to fucking grill them. Like, I'm going to grill them about every question I ever wanted to know about Metallica. You know, this isn't about, you know, you learned about me or whatever. Like, I want to know about you and like why you did this and the things that happened. And, you know, I don't know if I ever had that kind of same grill session with Iommi, because I never really went out getting, you know, hammered. Whereas with Lars and Metallica, like, we would go out and fucking rage until 8 a.m. You know, so you'd have that time. But it was good. And to me, that's like, if that's all I get out of it, you know, that's like the highlight of the, you know, like, you never, it's always a little weird meeting your idols. You know, there's something, you know, you try, you're talking to yourself like, okay, don't make this awkward or whatever, you know, and in some ways you kind of make it awkward because, you know, it's like, you're so, you know, like, overwhelmed. And so for me, I always just try and get past that and just talk, you know, because that is, you know, I don't know, just maybe it's just me being older. Like, that's the essence of life. Like, a fucking awesome conversation literally gets my blood pumping. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you know from being on the other side of that too, having fans come up to you that are just like, "Oh, this is my chance to have a couple moments with Rob Flynn. Like, what do I say? What do I do? What am I going to ask?" You know, and
right. And I always try and remember that when I talk to people, and there's that, you know, those people come up and they're completely just flustered and starstruck and they can't think of anything to say. And I'm like, I always tell them, like, relax, it's okay. Like, just hang, you know, and try and make that easier to get past, because of course I don't look at myself like that, but I know what that feeling is.
Yeah. And I think it's so relatable, something you hit upon, you know, talking about being around Iommi, where, you know, there's that thing in psychology I've read about, they call it imposter syndrome, where it's like, we always, no matter what we accomplish or who we are or where we're at, we always feel like, you know, we're going to get found out, that like, we don't belong, or, you know, it's that inner voice where, like you were saying, where you're kind of reminding yourself like, wait, I'm here. I'm like on this tour. I'm like supposed to be, you know, it's like, I wrote 10 Ton Hammer. Like, I'm like, I made it here, you know, because there's always that part where you're like, man, this guy's going to look at me and be like, what are you doing here again? Like, I'm going to be found out, you know?
And there's, you know, there's definitely in the music business, there's definitely, you know, more than a handful of those guys too. They usually don't last as long, so they get weeded out.
So getting back to the days of tape trading, around that time, demos were like albums. You know, I mean, I as a kid, I remember I didn't see too much distinction even between having like a live bootleg versus having a record. Once I kind of started to discover that scene, and I'm, you know, you've got a few years on me, not that many. You know, I was coming in behind you on all that stuff. But I'm curious, you know, what was the jump then from checking out those tapes and finding the record stores and discovering all these bands to then discovering shows? Because, I mean, you know, I'm a kid in Indiana, and like you said, you might as well have been on a different planet in the 80s because we didn't have the internet and cell phones and all that shit. But by the same turn, you were right there by the epicenter of the Bay Area thrash thing.
Sure.
And eventually, totally. You know, part of the second wave of that. So what was the transition from listening to this stuff to kind of participating, to going to shows? And, you know, when did you see Metallica play for the first time?
My friend, not to belabor Jim here, but, you know, I was a really introverted kid, you know, like, it was, you know, I really give him the credit for, you know, seeing something in me that I absolutely did not see in myself. You know, like, I always wanted to be on stage, you know, from the time I was a kid. I was always going out for the school play. I was always doing talent shows, but like off stage, if you want to call it, or just in regular, you know, non-stage life, I could barely hold conversations. And, you know, he was just my friend. He was just like, you know, you should play guitar. We need a guitar player to start a band. He's like, look, we need to start a band. You know, like, and I was like, okay. He's like, you should play guitar. And then we'd play guitar. And then he's like, you seem like the singer. You should be the singer. Like, it wasn't me going, I'm the singer. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it was him going, you seem like the singer. You should be the singer. And I was like, okay. And so just out of whatever, I just started singing because he saw something in me and just said, that's what I should do. And so I started doing it.
He was sort of your Lars in that sense.
He was.
Yeah, pushing you out there.
He totally was. And I, you know, and then I just didn't have the confidence. And so we got a singer and, you know, he was older than us and it was great because he could buy beer and stuff. So, but then he was like, we should go see, Exciter was coming to town. They put out the record Heavy Metal Maniac. And so we went to them, we were loving it. So we took Bart out to San Francisco and went out to see them at the Stone. And so, you know, this is a big trip on Bart, you know, it's a good hour out to the city. And then we get out there and it's a huge walk up to Broadway to get to the show. And we get there and we go to the show, we get right in the front row. And it was just, you know, the first time I'd ever seen a Circle Pit. I got up right in front of John Rishi, who was my guitar hero at the time, and just literally, I headbanged the whole time. The opening band was this band called Griffin. That somebody was talking shit to them in the front row. This dude standing directly in front of me was talking shit to the singer, and their fucking roadie jumped off the stage, like drops this dude right in front of me. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is crazy. Like, what's going on? This is crazy. The Circle Pit, I'd never seen a Circle Pit. So we got out so late, and then we ended up missing the BART train back. So we just stayed out in San Francisco at the BART station waiting for 6 a.m. to come, and, you know, took BART back the next morning. And then the next show that I went to, we had these friends that were these girls who were punk rockers. And so they were friends. They had an older metalhead brother, but we just became friends with these two girls who were punk rockers. And they're like, we were telling them about, hey, we went to our first thrash show. They're like, oh, you need to go to a punk rock show. We're like, really? What? Like, that sounds crazy. And they're like, no, we'll go. We'll protect you. Which was like, the girls will protect us.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was about, you know, par for the course for us. So me and my friend Leroy went with them. And these girls were like, they knew everybody. So they're like, we're going to go take you to go see DRI. So DRI on the Violent Pacification EP,
wow,
when all they drew was nothing but SF skins. So the only people who went to go see the DRI shows back in San Francisco back then were skinheads. So we walk in, and me and my friend have like shoulder length hair. You know, they take us to these squats where all of the skinheads are living. And so, you know, we're hanging out in these squats and we're shitting our pants, dude. I mean, like, these dudes are big and burly and gnarly and wasted, and we're just like, holy shit. You know, and they like the girls, so they're being cool. But they take us into the show. We're sitting there watching in the opening band, and this long-haired dude comes in, pays his $5 at the door, takes about four steps inside the venue, and this huge skinhead named Dagger, the leader of the SF skin, this guy named Dagger, walks up to him and drops him and goes, no long hairs. We're just like, me and my friend, like, we're wearing flannels. We just pull up the flannels like, oh my God, we're going to die. And DRI came on, and it looked basically just like a skinhead fight for the next hour, or, you know, probably wasn't even an hour, you know, probably 45 minutes, because their songs were so fucking short back then. But it was.
And we should probably pause for younger listeners and explain that when we were talking about skinheads, we're not necessarily talking about white supremacists, right?
Like, no. These were just crazy punk rock skinheads. These weren't like the racist white power skinheads. These are, you know, I think the SF skins were just crazy is what they were. They were just insane and super violent, but they didn't necessarily hate black people. They hated everybody, white long haired people and other white people. So
yeah,
it was brutal. I remember this guy, one of the guys we had met earlier, his name was Rob Noxious. And he jumped up on stage while DRI was playing, and he had a broken bottle, and he just fucking sat there and jammed it into his forehead, and blood just went pouring down his forehead. And then he just fucking smiled and jumped in and started punching people. And I was like, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it before or since, really. You know, like, it was just so, I mean, other than I saw Gigi Allen twice. And that was about as crazy as I've ever seen, but just crazy on a whole other level of crazy.
Yeah. I love hearing the nicknames too, because, you know, in all the way across the country in Indianapolis, growing up in my scene there in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, yeah, we had a skinhead named Snake, a skinhead named Shaggy. There were, you know, speaking of Gigi, there was a kid from Chicago that everyone called Black Gigi. was this black dude who was like his skinhead, but he was like crazy and did crazy stuff, and people start calling him GG, Black GG. And yeah. I mean, those that's almost like a lost art of the I mean, there's a lot of yahoos running around now with like self-appointed nicknames, but those nicknames that you earn that people put on you, like those were the legit ones.
Yeah. Right.
And then where they came with the story, you know, there was a skinhead dude in Indy called Merlin, and everyone called him Merlin because when people would trip on LSD, he would do quote unquote magic tricks.
Right.
So it was just Merlin, you know, like that's just what you called him.
Yeah. So that was my second show experience. And so, you know, this is my kind of formative, you know, introduction into punk rock and thrash. And, you know, it was, I mean, I walked away from that show terrified and thrilled.
Yeah.
And, you know, even now, like I just went and saw DRI like, you know, a month ago, and just, they're still killing it. And they're still, those songs are still awesome songs and super fast and just crazy. And the next show that was coming up, my friend Jim told me about, it was like Metallica's coming. We gotta go see them. Kill 'Em All had just dropped, and you know, it was funny because we were liking Kill 'Em All, but you know, the songs had changed quite a bit from the demo, so we were like, oh, I don't know about this.
But, yeah, exactly. All right.
But then we went. They were coming around, and it was Raven headlining, Metallica supporting, and then Exodus opening, and it was the Kill 'Em All for One tour over at the Berkeley Keystone, which was a venue in Berkeley, about 400 cap room, and so I had my dad drop us off, because you know I wasn't going to have my dad, you know, I had my dad drop us off two blocks away from the show, because I was like, I don't want, you know, thrashers to see my dad. So I'm a thrasher dad, you know, I can't be seen. So he dropped us off, and then he agreed to pick us up, which was very cool of him. And so we went and got in line. We met Paul Bailoff. We met James Hetfield, got an autograph from Hetfield. The first thing, he was just out in the crowd before the show, in between bands, signing autographs.
Wow.
And then they went on, and you know, it was with Cliff Burton, and I just sat there, and I didn't go up front because the Circle Pit was, it, the headbanging was fucking, it was too crazy up there, like with the stage difference. So me and my friend just kind of hung like at the edge of the pit and literally just headbanged the whole time. You know, I remember just being blown away by No Remorse. I remember Exodus killing it that night. Like they had the buzz of all buzzes, and yeah, they set up in front of everybody. Drums are like literally not even room for the cymbal stands on stage. People in the audience were holding the cymbals up so Dom could hit them. But, you know, they played No Love. They played Piranha.
Next song, it ain't about no goldfish. And it ain't about no tuna fish. And it ain't about no trout. This song is called Piranha.
And it was just, it was fucking, I mean, after that, so then Raven came on, and Raven was amazing. Raven was actually a really awesome live band, just a killer, killer live band, you know, super exciting, like really energetic. You know, they didn't quite have that aggression and that young sound, you know, it was still kind of like a nod to rock and roll.
Yeah.
Whereas Exodus and Metallica were clearly like a nod forward into something that really hadn't ever been done. You know, we ended up leaving halfway through because my dad was picking us up, and you know, so we had to go meet my dad. And obviously, this was before cell phones, so you just had to go. And it's okay, it's 10:45. We gotta go.
Yeah.
And I mean, literally the whole way home, Jim, all we talked about was, okay, we have to, like, we gotta get the band. Like, we have to be in a band. We gotta do shows. We've got to do something. Like, you know, that was literally the impetus for us. You know, for me, like you always hear like the older cats talk about seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and, yeah, you know, a million bands died after that. For me, the Kill 'Em All for One tour at the Keystone Berkeley, that was my Ed Sullivan Beatles.
Hell yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
Like after that, I was like, this is what I'm going to do. This is all I want to do. You know, like we have to do this, you know, and then you think of, you know, it's funny too, because I think about it, like, I mean, you're from Indiana, so obviously you didn't get to go see Metallica. You know, I mean, I guess you could have. They may have toured Indiana. I don't know. But
the first show that I know about being there, and it was slightly before I knew about the band, they came through with Armored Saint. I think they were opening for Armored Saint.
Right.
And, yeah, and I have some friends who are a couple years older than me that were at that show. One of those friends, who I ended up actually playing in a band with years later, he smoked weed with Cliff at that show. I believe it was at the Sherwood Theater in Indianapolis, and he has this funny story about him and his buddy smoking out with Cliff, and Cliff dozes off while they're hanging out with him. And they're like, dude, what should we do? Like, Cliff Burton's asleep. And, you know, and they're super high and they're teenagers, you know, and they're like, let's smell him. So he has this amazing story about leaning over and smelling Cliff Burton. So, yeah, he said he smelled like denim, kind of like denim in a wet basement.
Nice.
And some of those shows were, I don't know, the show that you went to, is that one of the ones that's on Cliff 'Em All? Because I know some of that Kill 'Em All for One stuff is on there.
I think the one from The Stone the next night in San Francisco is the one that's on there.
Okay, yeah, and that's the one that the Anesthesia that's on Cliff 'Em All. Oh,
sick. Yeah, and he did Anesthesia that night too.
Yeah, my first Metallica show was, my first metal show was Dio and Megadeth, actually, and it was the tour that was...
Oh, badass.
Yeah, it was Dio, Megadeth, and Sabotage, and for some reason Sabotage didn't play the Indianapolis date. I still have the Megadeth shirt that I bought there. And yeah, first time seeing Metallica was Monsters of Rock. This is what a thrash metal kid I was. It was Van Halen with Sammy Hagar headlining.
Mm-hmm.
The Scorpions, Dokken, Metallica, and Kingdom Come.
I remember this.
Yeah, Metallica was second of five on that bill. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, if that show were now, I'd be psyched on watching the Scorpions and Van Halen. But at the time, it was all like poser glam stuff. So my buddy and I went in Metallica shirts, paid whatever the Monsters of Rock ticket price was, stood with our middle fingers flipping off Kingdom Come their entire set. Everybody called him Kingdom Clone back then.
And, yeah, they're like,
and then yeah, dude,
they're like we're not influenced by Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and yeah, watched Metallica and left, and like we were home. It was still
daylight. Oh my god, you did the walkout,
dude. It was still daylight.
you did the hardcore dude walkout.
We did the hardcore dude walkout, and we yeah, and I remember they were playing Harvester of Sorrow, and Justice for All hadn't come out, and yeah, it's like pre-internet. Metallica's not on the radio, so it was such an amazing thrill to hear a new song that wasn't out yet in the live setting, you know? And then I remember there was a picture in the newspaper the next day. So I guess Jason Newsted's family was in Michigan and his dad had driven down to see Metallica there. And there was this picture of Jason Newsted's dad up front in a Metallica shirt. That's like Metallica bass player, Jason Newsted's father in Indianapolis. Oh, like,
that's awesome.
And yeah, and I'm such a fan you know, cut that out of the paper and had it on my wall with all my posters and shit, you know? So obviously I wish that I'd gotten to see them sooner, but you know, it's funny. We're talking about different entry points for bands. The Garage Days EP was like the quote unquote current Metallica release when I got into them. That had just come out, you know? So it's like, obviously, you know, I'm a massive, massive, massive disciple of Cliff Burton. But yeah. I mean, you know, Newsted was in the band, what, like 14 years? I mean, he was the bass player for my friends and I.
Oh, yeah.
He was the guy in the band, you know?
And he was kind of the thrash dude, too. You know, like, I think everybody, all the true thrashers kind of, like, when they started going more rock, he was still playing, you know, he'd wear the thrash shirt or the Slayer shirt or the Violence shirt or anything. And it was like, oh, cool.
Yeah, well, even, is it Inside Load where he's wearing the Machine Head hoodie? I remember around that era, he was wearing Machine Head and Sepultura stuff all the
time. Yeah, he was a big supporter of the band, for sure, man.
Yeah, always had his ear to the ground. And I remember that era even... Right when he first joined the band, he would always rep for Sacred Reich and Atrophy and all of those, all the Arizona bands that he came up with. And
yeah, he gave a big push for the band. He, you know, we did a Donington Monsters of Rock in '95, right after the first album came out. And it was, you know, pretty much because of him. I mean, all the dudes basically told me, yeah, it was Jason who got you on.
Wow.
Like, wow. Yeah. So, you know, huge,
incredible.
Huge, you know, champion for the band.
So what was your, you know, going from that seminal Kill 'Em All for One show and going like, okay, I gotta get in a band. Was there a band before you joined Forbidden? Well, I guess it would have been Forbidden Evil back then, right? Or was it
Forbidden Evil, yeah. It would have been, well, we were originally called Inquisitor, which was named after a Raven Udo Dirkschneider B-side that had come out, because my buddy was a big Raven fan and we were loving Accept. So they put out a B-side called Inquisitor, and we didn't even know what the fucking word meant. We're like, cool word.
Yeah, it sounds metal.
Let's call ourselves that. Yeah, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of thought process into it. And then there was a Metal Massacre 3 that came out, and we were like, hey, we're going to change our name from Inquisitor. We're going to call it something else. And there was a Metal Massacre 3 that came out, and there was a band. I think it was the last song on the record, and I can't remember the name of the band. I actually got the name from Brian Slagle. You know what? Let me look it up real quick. I know Brian Slagle texted me the name of the band. Let me see here if I can find it. Brian Slagle. Yeah, here it is. What the fuck was it? Anyway, there was a song on there by this band, and it was called Forbidden Evil. And so I was like, we should call our band Forbidden Evil after this song title by this other band on a Metal Massacre 3. And so that's basically how Forbidden Evil came to be. And then I left and they changed it to just Forbidden. The demons scream from hell.
Oh man, that is and by the way, I'm also trying to find that Metal Massacre 3.
Warcry. That's it. I'm just reading through the text. So the band was called Warcry.
Amazing.
Yeah, and they had a song called Forbidden Evil. So, you know, and then you think about the Metal Massacres and you think about how influential those things were. You know, like those things probably sold nothing. You think about like the influence and the reach that those things had. They had the very first Metallica song.
I mean, it was part of the formation of Metallica, right? I mean, yeah, it's like Metallica may not have even happened without, hey, I've got a spot for you on this comp.
Yeah, and then the next one's got, you know, the very first Slayer song that anybody's ever going to hear. They've got this Warcry Forbidden Evil song that came out. Like a million other bands talk. Like, it's just, there was so much that came from that small little thing, and you know, here we are in, you know, fucking Fremont being influenced by it. And so yeah, so then from there, you know, I don't get back to your question, like where did we get, yeah, so that was the band. And then we just started gigging around, you know, we're playing house parties, we're playing all of our Thrasher friends' backyard parties. And you know, like at that time Fremont was like, you know, like we were a bunch of white trash kids, you know, like it was a lot of, you know, that none of us had a lot of money. And so we're just playing in our friends' backyards, and their parents were cool enough to buy some kegs for their crummy 18-year-olds and host us.
Yeah.
We were playing with punk rock bands and other thrash bands. And, you know, it's funny because half of our set would literally be thrash covers. So we played a couple of our original songs, and then we'd do A Lesson in Violence by Exodus, which Bonded by Blood wasn't even out. We were playing the demo version of it. It was the pre-release. I don't know if you remember, but back in before Bonded by Blood came out, Bonded by Blood was out and available for 6 months before the record dropped in the underground scene. So we had it was the official album, but it was like the pre-release or whatever it was. So here we are 6 months ahead of the record playing. We're playing A Lesson in Violence. We're playing Black Magic by Slayer. We're playing Whiplash by Metallica. We're doing our own originals, playing backyard parties. We started playing church, like 4F clubs and church halls and stuff like that. And we just get a buddy, rent him out, and, you know, rent out a hall. And in a weird way, we kind of created this little microcosm of a scene in Fremont.
I mean, and that's the same thing that Metallica was doing when you think about it, because their early shows were mostly Diamond Head songs, you know, Budgie and, like, you know, and stuff was somewhat contemporaneous with what they were doing, but just unknown, you know. So if you were going to see Metallica in Anaheim and they're doing like 4 Diamond Head songs, they just seem like Metallica songs in the crowd.
No one would know the difference.
Yeah.
And so then we started getting, and then we got Craig in the band, and Craig was, you know, Craig was the guitar player in Forbidden and kind of probably the most, you know, well, he was the spoke, eventually became the spokesperson for the band. And him and I had gotten into metal too. And he was a couple years younger than me. So he was turning me on to even other stuff like Venom and all that stuff. And then he kind of became, you know, he was like, he had that gift of gab, you know, which I did not have. You know, and I don't know if I have now, but, you know, he definitely had it back then, and I definitely did not have it back then. So he started calling up all the thrash clubs, you know, Mabuhay Gardens, where I had seen DRI, Ruthie's Inn, where we had seen Possessed and Exodus and all these bands. And he's like, this is where we need to go. We need to get into the thrash clubs because then we'll become a real band. And, you know, like if we can make it there, then, you know, we can make it anywhere. And so we started playing those kind of shows, Rock on Broadway, The Stone, the Ruthie's Inn, like the real thrash shows. And we went over okay. You know, we didn't go over as good as, say, the main thrash bands, but we didn't get killed. So that was kind of the dividing line. Like, there was no in between. Like, either you just got, you know, people just, you know, it wasn't even heckling. Like, back then, people would, like, fight you off the stage. You know, like, dudes just get up and literally, like, take microphones and push guitar players off the stage, you know, like Toby Rage and all these crazy dudes around the Exodus crew. Like, if you weren't heavy enough and if you weren't bringing it, like, it was a violent end. They would fight you. They would, like, beat you. You know, they would try and steal your guitars at the end of the night. You know, like, they're dicks. You know, like,
yeah.
it was pretty lame. But if you could do, you know, if you could do good, then, you know, they'd kind of give you that nod and you'd be welcomed in. And we, you know, they gave us that nod. And I don't know if they accepted us because, you know, we were quite a bit younger. We were a good 5 years behind that scene. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we were playing our first shows like 86, 87. So, you know, it was well on its way. But, you know, to get a nod from them was a big deal and, you know, gave us this grit. And then, you know, of course, in Fremont, like, our cred just skyrocketed.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, you mentioned Ruthie's Inn. I've got a... And this is, again, you know, growing up in the Midwest and it being like this mythical other place where all this magic is happening. But yeah, I have this bootleg of the second Megadeth show that was at Ruthie's Inn with Kerry King on guitar. And
nice.
I think Exodus and Legacy were supporting. Right. That might as well have been Camelot or something to me, this club out there, you know.
Yeah, and to hear that the dude from Slayer was in Megadeth, like, that
exactly.
was huge, you know,
exactly.
It was like, oh my God, like, this is going to be the best band ever,
yeah.
You know, and then the beef happened, you know, and then the beef with Metallica happened, and then, you know, Mustaine and Kirk Hammett and, you know, Metallica guys versus Slayer, and like, you know, like, I think that it's often, and I talk about this a lot, but I think that, you know, the one thing that often gets, you know, with time, and of course it's been 30 years, so, you know, people kind of forget, but dude, the rivalry between those bands was vicious. It was so brutal. Like, if you liked Slayer and you lived in the Bay Area, it was like, you're a poser, like, they wear eyeliner, you know, like,
yeah,
it was like,
yeah.
Beef. And then Mustaine would come up to the Bay Area all the time, and literally, dude, I'd go see Megadeth, he'd dedicate a good 10 minutes to talking shit about Kirk Hammett, talking shit about, fuck those guys, they stole all my riffs, Kirk Hammett's playing all my leads note for note, he's a wannabe. I mean it was merciless, dude, like,
yeah.
And so there was that beef, and, you know, people often forget, you know, like, the beef between Slayer. I mean, I remember, my buddy has a recording of it. I don't have a recording of it, but Lars and James went on KUSF and they did a phony interview where Lars was a journalist and James pretended to be Kerry King and they were interviewing Slayer. And dude, it was the funniest fucking thing. It was ruthless, dude. Like,
this is totally unknown to me. I've never heard of that.
He's like, oh, I like all these upside down crosses. He's like, oh yeah, I like to hang upside down too. And, you know, just super funny and just ripping them, dude. And so that there, you know, there was a pretty serious beef between them. And if you think about it, you know, now it looks all great because, oh, it's the big four and whatever. Dude,
yeah.
Slayer didn't play with Metallica any of those dates. They hated each other's guts, dude, for decades. They refused to get them on a bill, you know. And then around the time that we were doing the Death Magnetic dates, I started, like, planting the seeds, like, as Lars, like, hey, man, like, how come you guys never tour with Slayer? Is it because of the fucking beef? Like, get over that shit. You guys should tour. And so after the Forum show, funny you should bring up that Forum show, I, you know, Kerry came down, he was talking, we were hanging, and I'm hanging with him at the bar, and Lars walks up, and I was like, I got to do it. Like, I got to do this. And I was like, how come you motherfuckers have never toured with each other?
Like, nice. I just
threw it out there. They're like, oh, and I was like, you guys need to tour. I was like, that shit would be amazing. It would be awesome. And, you know, conversation goes on. They talk. They're like, yeah, you know, maybe we should. You know, the next night, Lars played a little Rain and Blood. And, you know, so then it ends away. And, like, Lars walks away and Kerry looked at me and he's like, I owe you for that one.
That's so fucking killer.
And then, you know, it took a couple of years, but
yeah. Well, I mean, that was a lot of moving parts to put in place.
How amazing that it got to happen. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say it was, you know, obviously.
No. But it's a convergence of events.
You know, from a business standpoint, it was a genius move on Metallica's part. But, you know, this little seed that I planted along the way in my fandom being part, you know, being just part of the, you know, part of the mix. Like, hey, you know.
And I believe, and I believe it was kind of fated to happen right exactly when it did too, because if you look at that specific moment in time, you had Slayer original lineup, you know, Jeff was still around and Lombardo was still in the band, and you had Ellefson had just come back into Megadeth. And I think, you know, and he's a buddy of mine, so I'm a little biased, but I think Rob Casciano is the best lead guitar player Anthrax has had. And, you know, Joey just come in the band, which made a lot of fans happy. It was just kind of like a perfect moment for that to happen, where any kind of moment just before or even since, it wouldn't have been the same show or as cool of a show as the Big Four was when it finally happened, you know? Yeah, I mean, and thank you as a fan for playing a role in bringing that together. So did you have a sense, you know, when it was, and obviously then moving on into Violence, you know, Death Angel, obviously Legacy and Becoming Testament and all of that, Defiance, some of those bands that were around in that Bay Area, did you have a sense that it was a scene and it was kind of, you know, whether it was the second wave or whatever you want to call it, like a couple of years later that it was?
I always considered us third wave. So to me, it was like Metallica, Exodus, Slayer, Megadeth, and then it was like Testament, Death Angel. And then it was Forbidden Violence.
But did you feel like it was a movement? Like, were you aware that you were kind of part of something that was happening? You know, because I'm always curious about that with various scenes in general. You know, like that fans kind of, we create these movements after the fact, right?
It's so funny because when I look back at that time, I didn't realize that I was a part of this special scene. You know, this was just, you know, like I said, I'm getting dropped off by my dad. I'm 17 years old. Like, I'm going to a show. And then, you know, we got into Ruthie's and we started playing. And then now I'm hanging out at Ruthie's and, like, in walks James Hetfield and in walks Cliff Burton and in walks Paul Bailoff and Gary Holt. And granted, you know, like I said, I was still kind of, you know, I don't want to say shy, but I was shy. Like, and I was 5 years younger than all those guys. So it's not like I was, like, so... like Craig could have walked up to all those guys and just started yapping. I couldn't have done that, you know, and I didn't, you know, I didn't. I was, you know, like, I remember, like, we bought a joint off of James Hetfield one time. and it was like the biggest thrill for me. I was like, oh my God, we just, you know, like, and it was, you know, I doubt that he would tell that story these days, but it was definitely happened. And it was bad. It was so bad too. It was like the dirtest dirt weed.
Of course.
But, you know, like, and just to be able to see this, like, and then to watch it rise, you know, to watch them go from, oh, now I'm seeing them play two nights at the Kabuki with Armored Saint opening. Oh, wow, now I'm watching them headline at the San Francisco Civic on New Year's, and they just played two songs off of Master of Puppets, and I don't even really like these songs. You know, like, it was funny because, like, you know, then I started getting into heavier stuff, and then, like, Rain and Blood comes out, SOD came out, and it was like, ah, Metallica, but, you know, and then Fade to Black, and I was like, what's going on? But then you just watch this meteoric rise happening with this band that is kind of doing it their own way, and it's not pandering to radio, and it's not part of this super poppy glam stuff that's going on, and it's like, wow, maybe there is a different way that this can be done. And, you know, granted, I probably never even would talk to these guys. Like, I still just couldn't go up and talk to them. And, but, you know, it was inspiring to me. And then our band started doing well, and we would, you know, I don't want to say follow, but yeah, we would I mean, it was a huge inspiration to go, wow, look at Metallica just did what? They just did the Bill Graham Civic. Holy shit. They just did the Oakland Arena opening the Day on the Green, you know, like, I'm seeing all these things.
Yeah.
And you know, and watching all of these things. And it's like, we can do this, man. Like, we can do this. Like, we can do a band and play this crazy heavy music, and it's going to react. And, you know, it might have only been 5 years, really, when it, if you really look at, like, the thrash scene in the Bay Area, like, 83 to 88 is really, like, when it was probably the, you know, because after that, you know, like, after 80, and you got to remember, like, 88, like, Metallica's dropping A Justice for All, Cliff passed away, you know, Testament started moving towards, you know, Practice What You Preach and getting more commercial. So, you know, it really started ending around 80, and then grunge stuff started coming up, Soundgarden, you know, this kind of new stuff, funk, Primus, you know, Chili Peppers. So that 5 year period where Bay Area had just suffered a really brutal economic recession. You know, so there's like, I mean, it's really, really run down. You know, Bay Area, you know, it wasn't until like 90s, late 90s that huge Silicon Valley boom happened.
Yeah.
And the Bay Area just kind of, you know, rebuilt itself. But back in the 80s, it was, you know, it was desolate. You know, you went into any major inner cities and it was just abandoned homes. And, you know, like all that, that kind of poorness that the cities, all of the cities were going through. You know, people, what do they want to do? They want to go to shows. They want to go drink their sorrows away. So all these music venues were available for people to go do that. And, you know, there was no security. There was no barricades. There was no insurance. Like, you know, I remember like, what's that? You know, security was the old guy. I remember the security guy at Ruthie's was the old black dude with a gun. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It wasn't like, oh no, I've got security guards and, you know, some security force. Like if you broke your, you know, I remember breaking my ribs, you know, breaking my nose, you get in a fight at a show. It was a badge of honor. You wouldn't even think about suing somebody. That would like, you'd be a poser. You know what I mean? Like that was a badge of honor to get injured in the Exodus pit or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a totally different mindset. And that mindset obviously, you know, forever changed the way that I looked at the world and created music and inspired what we do. And, you know, I mean, not to just dwell on that too, because then rap came along in 84 also, and rap was massive in our world. It was like, you know, so we had punk rock, rap, and metal. And to us, there was really no difference. It was all aggressive.
Yeah. There's such connective tissue between all of it. Yeah. And it was all storytelling and vibe and energy from a certain point of view that, you know, those of us who had the right chemical combination of family life and economic class and all that stuff. You put all those ingredients together, and yeah, I mean, because I'd say, you know, I, like you said, those guys are about 5 years ahead of you. You're about 5 or 6 years ahead of me. And I had that exact same experience. I mean, those formative years of Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, all the Testament, all those bands being important to me. At the same time, it was also Boogie Down Productions, Public Enemy, yeah. NWA, obviously,
the,
you know,
super pissed off, like super angry. You know?
Yeah,
like,
I mean, like, dude, listening to X-Clan and being scared, you know, like.
Totally. I saw X-Clan live, too.
No way.
Yeah, with Cypress Hill and B-Money from Digital Underground. It was Cypress Hill headlining, but X-Clan supporting. They were terrible. They were fucking stupid. I was like, it seemed scary on record, but like live, I was like, this shit's just corny.
Yeah,
like all the African garb, and I was like, I can't.
And they couldn't get away with calling people sissies now. That would be triggering everyone.
Right.
Remember, that was the thing, you sissies. man, it's and kind of bringing us full circle with some of this tape trading and getting into things and sort of that network that went from, you know, people writing letters back and forth to fanzines to then getting into some magazines that were nationally distributed. The first time I heard of Violence was that Mechanic Records ad that was in magazines that was like,
oh right,
you could mail in and get the demo. And yeah, I mean, it was like, that's what I mean, like the Violence demo then to me wasn't any, I didn't distinguish that from like a commercially released like major label album, you know. It was all the same to me, like it was all just as vital and important and cool. So
yeah. Don't be lies and it's a real color to the belly you today. The family, the feel, the voices, the same as you say.
Well, dude, I got to have you on for a part two. because there's still so much more Metallica to talk.
I know. We got up to about 88. We can go from 88 till now.
Exactly. Yeah, and I will say on that tip, you know, I love hearing you talk about even the change in songs between No Life to Leather to Kill 'Em All, and then, you know, hearing Fade to Black, because I always find myself in these conversations with people who are younger than me. You know, it's all time, place, and circumstance. Like, it depends on when and where they discovered the band and, you know, where their point of discovering things that were more extreme or whatever came in. Because you'll hear people say, you know, the Black album was a turning point for them, or of course, you know, Load and Reload and whatever. And I always say, like, dude, there were fans back in the day that were pissed off about Fade to Black. Like, they've been turning these corners and going forward, whether the fans liked it or not, and doing what made sense to them and being true to themselves from the beginning. You know, it was always, yeah. There were always those moments. And I remember going to the record store, you know, and like, I wasn't old enough to drive yet. But in 88, when Injustice for All came out, like going down there on Street Date and riding in the back of some dude's pickup truck who was like a total asshole who drove my friend and I down there and was like, you know, taking every crazy turn, like trying to basically throw us out of his truck.
Oh, my God.
And we're like literally like risking our lives to get to the record store to get Injustice for All. And then sitting with the five or six metalheads in my high school in our little tiny section of the cafeteria and everyone being bummed out. Because the record was slow. Like, everyone's like, oh, Dire's Eve is the only good song, you know? And now it's like, that's a classic
totally.
Album.
I remember listening to it being like, what is with this, the sound on this record? Like, you know, I remember that, even now, like, I'm not a big fan of the song Injustice for All. It's so freaking long. You know, I'm just like, you know, but I remember listening to it back then and being like, what is the deal? You know, in like 88, like everything was starting to change. You know, like, and it was like everything was starting to change. You know, like there was these new things coming. They were going in a different direction. And, you know, you kind of lose your footing as a fan. And you're like, I don't, like, what is going on with everybody? And, you know, of course, yeah, like now, like, think about it. Without the song One.
I can't remember anything. Can't tell if this is true or a dream. Deep down inside, I feel the scream. This terrible silence stops in there.
I mean, think about that one song. If they wouldn't have had that one song, there never would have been the video. There never would have been that huge step that they made. You know, that, you know, and there's some great songs on that record. Blackened is amazing. You know, Dire's Eve is amazing. Short of Straw is amazing. Harvester of Sorrow is amazing. But One, you know, and then they had to make the controversial. Remember, they were like, "We'll never make a video."
And then I remember Lars even had the excuse then, where it's like, "Well, but it's not like a traditional music video because it has these film clips in it, and there's dialogue, and you know, and MTV's upset about it. They don't like. We didn't make it for them." And then I remember around the Black Album when they would just put out straight up performance videos, and it's like, "Well, that went out the window." Remember the jamming version?
That one song changed the course of the band.
Yeah.
You know, like it literally took them from, okay, here's some hard rock, you know, here's some underground metal stuff that's doing good, to like, whoa, this could really be a massive thing. You know, and I remember listening to it, and I remember watching that video, and, you know, I don't know if I was caught up in it, like, as much as everybody else was. I didn't really care, because I was more interested in seeing what this unique video was going to be about, and when I saw it, I was like, wow, cool video.
Yeah.
I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
So I also had
that attitude where, you know, it's like you want these bands to stay yours, and these scenes and these movements to stay yours, but I also, you know, I was different from, I think, some other fans, where I also championed the successes. Like, I felt some validation when some things that I liked, whether it's movies, comic books, whatever, kind of broke through, because it was kind of like, yeah, I wasn't a fucking bizarre loser weirdo for liking that shit. That shit's actually fucking badass, and now everyone likes it. Fuck you. You know, I always had a little bit of that other chip on my shoulder to balance out the chip that's mad that people are getting into the stuff you like. And I had the distinction of being in high school. I was a senior in high school when the Black Album came out, and it was right towards the end of my high school experience.
Everybody got into the Black Album.
Yeah, It Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Your whole school got into the Black Album.
Seriously, like all of a sudden jocks and football players were wearing Metallica shirts, and it definitely had, and that of course is when me and all my friends are then like, well, we like Morbid Angel.
Yeah,
right. You know, it's like, we don't listen to that poser watered down stuff. We're into the, like, we listen to death. We listen to, you know, and there's always going to be that, but
I love the Black Album. I loved it back then.
I love it. I loved it then. And honestly, and I, you know, and you and I may diverge here, but I'm a longtime defender of the Load Reload era.
There's a couple of good songs, I don't hate it. You know, like, I love the song Devil Dance. I love the song, I love Fuel. I think Fuel is amazing. I love Memory Remains. Like, I think that song's awesome.
And you know what's great about those two songs in particular is now that they have such a catalog, when they're, you know, I just saw them at the Rose Bowl, it gives them dynamics in their set. You know, when you can throw Fuel in right after, Blackened or something, and it's like, it really kind of breaks it up without having to be a ballad, you know. But dude, I would put The Outlaw Torn and Bleeding Me.
Yeah, those are great songs too.
Yeah, those are like in my top Metallica songs, period. You know, and I with Saint Anger, it's like I understand why it had to happen.
Frantic's killer, Saint Anger's killer, rest of it's horrible.
I think Frantic with some editing.
Yeah,
you know, but yeah,
the hook is good.
And this is where my super fanboy comes out, because I'll dig this deep. But there's an acoustic version of All Within My Hands that they did at one of the Bridge School benefits that redeems that song, where it's like, oh, well, this is cool in this arrangement.
Love is control. I'm dying.
Here's my stance on Lulu. I've said this before. I've said this on this podcast before. Lulu would be fine if it were something that, you know, they got the opportunity to do it. Don't fault them for trying. Put it in the vault. And then someday when, like, you've retired or you can't physically play anymore, like when it's become a legacy act that's like a Tupac or an Elvis, where there's all this like random shit coming out, that's when you go, hey, this is crazy. But one time Metallica made an album with Lou Reed.
And then they shelved it.
And it came
out 30 years after everybody died.
Yeah, now it's a curiosity of like, oh, what a weird random thing. That is the context in which.
But either way, that's your context. But what do you think of Lulu?
Yeah, I mean, it would still be terrible, but it would
be horrible.
But it would be like interesting.
Like, there's no, there is nothing. It is horrible. Like, I we actually have a game in Machine Head. It's the Lulu Endurance Test, where, like, if you drive to Los Angeles, try and listen to Lulu twice and see if you can survive. Like, it's mind-bogglingly bad, you know. Like, and I hate, you know what? And I hate Lou Reed. Like, I've never liked Lou Reed. I never even got the whole, like, why is this even happening? You know, like, Lou Reed had the, you know, he had the one good song. Like, everybody thinks he's cool. I never thought he was cool. Like, I never got
it. And I mean, that song in my mind,
it seemed like some dickhead at Rolling Stone was like, hey, why don't you guys jam with Lou Reed? And somebody went, yeah, cool idea. Like, you know, like, it just was such a random pairing of people, you know, like, I don't know.
You can feel the effort on both sides in trying to make something work that shouldn't have and ultimately didn't, you know. But yeah, and even that Doot to Doot song, it was only cool when Tribe Called Quest sampled it and made it cool.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the only reason I even like that song.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
I love that they can joke about it now, though. Like, I think that they, you know, even if they will defend it, you know, because they're going to defend it. And I even got it. Yeah. Stefan Shirazi is the guy who writes for the fan club.
Yeah, of course.
Awesome, dude. I love Stefan Shirazi. He's been a friend of mine for ever, and even him and I got into it the other, you know, this is like a year ago at my manager's wedding. Like, so we're both drunk, we're sitting at the bar, and he's like, "Lulu is fun." I'm like, "Shut the fuck up, dude!" I was like, "That record." I'm not even gonna hear this. Like, I'm not gonna hear you. Like,
but yeah, if it was a curious thing that we could discuss somewhere after the fact, but to be kind of passed off as an official release and that they played shows around it and. You know, they even did on those 30th anniversary shows, they even did some, busted out some Lulu and busted out some Bob Rock on bass.
Yeah. You know what? And you know what? Good for them. Those anniversary shows were amazing.
Amazing.
They were.
Yeah.
I mean, like, just for so much just pure history and, you know, the little museum area where you could walk around and, you know, cliff spaces and, of you know, course. Just even that stuff, you know, like Bob Rock on bass. Like, that was. Yeah. That was cool.
That's where it should happen.
Cool. It's like, you know, I have to say, like, but through it all, I have to say they are, you know, if there was anything that I admire about them, and yes, of course, James Hetfield, right hand, has been, you know, one of, you know, the guiding lights of my light. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. His right hand is still, you know, him and Kerry King are, you know, the ones to beat.
Unstoppable.
But,
unstoppable.
But, you know, and musically, of course, you know, it's been massive. But the one thing I will say about them and the way that they conduct their stuff, and, you know, there is definitely some myth-making that goes on in the Metallica camp. But for all of the myth-making that that band has and are geniuses at, they're freaking geniuses at it, they are so brutally, brutally honest. And put out so much of their victories and their flaws and their mistakes. And, you know, they own up to it. They never, you know, back away from it. You know, I mean, I've talked with the Slayer guys about this before, like some kind of monster. Like, they're, you know, some of those guys in that camp are like, I would never do that as long as I lived. And I sit there and look at it and go, I'm so glad they did that, because it shows people at their most fragile, at their most vulnerable, at their weakest, you know, like our hero, James Hetfield, you know, like in this, the depths of this, like, reconstruction of his whole identity, and to put it out there. You know, to show the fighting, to show that I don't even know who you are anymore. You know, like Lars yelling in James Hetfield's face, like, dude, like that took ball. I don't think no one can understand the balls that it took, especially because they're so big to put all of that out there. You know, some people walked away from that like, oh my God, I hate Metallica. They went, I walked away from it going, I love Metallica probably more than I ever have. Because
100%,
it's so scary and so fearless to just go, all right, let's put it out. Here's me acting like a complete baby. You know, who does that? You know, and especially now, think about society now. Society now would never, like, everybody's life is about putting the best selfie up and the best picture of them and the best thing. Like, that whole idea of putting yourself looking like crap is so foreign to most people, you know, now, because all we ever want to do is talk about the good things going in our life and the good things happening to us. We rarely ever let out our flaws. And for to watch a band of that magnitude, you know, literally the biggest band in metal and possibly even rock music at that point, to bear, put it all out there, dude, you know, respect.
I couldn't agree more. And I was a reporter for MTV at the time, and they had sent me to the Sundance Film Festival to interview Hilary Duff's sister, who was in a movie called Napoleon Dynamite that, you know, was at Sundance and no one had ever heard of. And it was literally like I interviewed her for a piece that went on TRL. But I knew the Metallica movie was there and got into a screening. And, nice. Dude, I mean, I felt Newstead's anger. I felt, I'm like the only dude clapping when Kirk says, yeah, but if we do a record without guitar solos because no one has guitar solos right now, it's going to make it sound dated to right now. And I'm like, yeah, you know, just the little, yeah, little tidbits. And then obviously the big emotional beats. And I mean, I literally, you know, I don't cry at movies, and I got teary sitting through that. And you kind of start relating it to your own life, and
totally,
you feel like you're growing up with these people. And yeah, I mean, you put it, I couldn't put it any better than you just did. It was, I mean, just beautiful. And I feel the same way. I'm so glad they did that. And they actually at Sundance did a press conference. It's in the DVD bonus features. This is my only Metallica claim to fame, where the band was in Hawaii while we're all freezing our asses off at Sundance. And they did a
video conference.
Yeah, they did a satellite press conference where there was a big screen with them on it. And
yeah, Hawaii.
A microphone. Yeah, and I got up, and you got one question. I got up and I'm like, hey, I'm Ryan Downey from MTV News, and just want to say, you know, how much I love the film and this and that. And I was the dude, the thrash kid that asked the Dave Mustaine question. I'm like, I want to talk about that scene with Dave Mustaine, which, I mean, no, we'd all just seen it for the first time that morning, you know? And I'm like, you know, James, you didn't have an opportunity to be there. Like, what would you have said if you were there? And, yeah, so that's in the, you know, if anyone listening to this wants to dig out there some kind of monster DVD and watch the bonus features, I'm in there for 2 seconds.
Awesome. That's killer.
Well, Rob, dude, thank you so much for making the time to do this. When I had the idea to do this podcast, my list of people that I really wanted to have on here, you were right up there in that top five. I'm really glad you were able to take the time to do it. I definitely want to have you on again because there's always awesome, so much Metallica to talk about. And we'll just remind people that you're Rob Flynn, the general from Machine Head, and they can find you in all sorts of places.
Yeah. Well, man, thanks for having me. This was awesome, dude. This was really fun. And you know, like, again, like I was saying, like, a great conversation, like, makes my blood pump. This was rad.
100%. That's the whole, thanks that's for having the whole me. Reason. I'll talk to you soon. That was fucking killer. He's great. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed listening to that as much as I loved participating in it. Check out all of our previous episodes if you haven't yet, including our kickoff flagship episode with M. Shadows of Avenged Sevenfold, which was also equally no less killer than this episode. I want to remind you that thanks to my friends at Warner Music, I am giving away a deluxe collector's edition of the Kill 'Em All box set. Yes, that is the box set that comes with a big, huge book and a whole bunch of other stuff to a random person who leaves a review in the iTunes store for Speak and Destroy. As soon as we get up to 100 reviews, we're going to pick someone from that group of wonderful people who've taken the time to write a little review in the iTunes store, because those reviews matter. They help people discover this podcast. You can find me at Ryan Downey on Twitter, at Superhero HQ on Instagram. You can find Speak and Destroy on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter as well. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. To paraphrase the great Dave Mustaine, as I try to do in everything that I host, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.